Get ready to dive deep into some seriously fascinating biblical history. We are going to crack open 2 Kings chapters 3 and 4 and just explore the ministries of these two prophets, Elijah and Elisha.
Okay.
You have sent in excerpts from Dr. John Oswalt's lectures.
Yes.
And expert speakers here to guide us through some really intriguing events. And what is so interesting is we're not just dealing with miracles and prophecies, but also a power struggle playing out against the backdrop of this spiritual crisis.
Yeah.
The fight to keep Baal worship from overtaking the worship of Yahweh in these kingdoms of Israel and Judah.
That's right. And it's a conflict that runs much deeper than just political maneuvering. You know, yeah. It's a clash of worldviews, a struggle between trusting in the one true God and giving in to the temptations of worldly desires. And Dr. Oswalt does a fantastic job of teasing out these complexities in his lectures.
Okay, so let's set the stage. So we're in the aftermath of King Ahab's death. Mm-hmm. His reign was heavily influenced by his wife Jezebel, mm-hmm. and it really pushed this Baal worship in Israel. And wouldn't you know it, as soon as he's gone, Moab, who had been under Israel's control for almost 2 centuries, decides it's their chance to break free.
Yes. This rebellion is a major turning point. Not only does it represent a political shakeup, but it also throws into sharp relief the spiritual instability of the region.
Right.
Remember, Ahab and Jezebel's promotion of Baal worship had eroded the faith of many Israelites.
Ooh.
And this weakness is now on full display.
So Ahab's son takes over, but doesn't last very long, right? Mm-hmm. And then his brother Jehoram steps in, and he's a bit of a mixed bag, isn't he?
Yeah.
Trying to distance himself from the whole Baal thing,
yeah.
but not fully embracing Yahweh either.
Exactly. Jehoram is what Dr. Oswalt calls double-minded.
Yeah.
And, you know, this isn't just about hedging his bets between two gods. It's about a deeper inner conflict.
Right.
You know, this divided loyalty, this attempt to serve God and the world at the same time, it creates a constant tension, a sense of never truly knowing where you stand.
And I imagine that kind of spiritual instability makes it incredibly hard to lead, especially during a crisis, which is exactly what happens next.
Yeah.
Jehoram decides to take back Moab and calls in King Jehoshaphat of Judah for backup.
And here's where things get really interesting. Instead of taking the direct route north through Israel's territory, Jehoram insists on going south through Edom.
Mm.
Strategically, it doesn't seem to make much sense.
It does seem like an odd choice.
Yeah.
You know, if I were Jehoshaphat, I'd be wondering what's going on.
Right, right.
After all, his father had some pretty bad experiences with Ahab. Maybe Jehoram was worried about the level of support he'd have back home.
That's a great point. Jehoram's easing up on Baal worship might not have been popular with everyone. Maybe going through Edom was a way to avoid potential conflict within his own kingdom.
Political intrigue. So they set off on this southern route, and after 7 days, they find themselves in the middle of the desert with no water.
Yep.
And how does Jehoram react? He immediately blames Yahweh. Talk about adding insult to injury.
This is a classic example of that double-mindedness we were talking about. You know, when you are trying to straddle the fence between faith and worldly desires, any setback can feel like God is against you. You lack that firm foundation of trust.
Right.
That confidence that he is in control, even when things are tough.
It makes you wonder if Jehoram was truly seeking God's will in this whole endeavor, or if he was just using Yahweh as a convenient excuse for his own ambitions.
Yeah.
Luckily, Jehoshaphat has a very different response, doesn't he?
Yes. His first instinct is to seek guidance from a prophet of Yahweh. He has a history of trusting in God. So his response to this crisis is rooted in faith, not fear.
Mm.
What is fascinating here is that we see this stark contrast between these two kings, both facing the same situation, but their worldviews shaping their entire approach.
It really shows how our understanding of God influences how we navigate challenges.
Yeah.
So is this where Elisha makes his grand entrance?
It is, and it is not quite what you'd expect. It turns out he's been traveling with the army this whole time, completely undercover.
Wait, really a prophet spy? I never pictured Elisha like that.
Oh, right, and when Jehoram starts complaining about Yahweh,
yeah.
Elisha calls him out. You know, saying, if you are so sure God is against you, why not ask your parents' gods for help?
Wow.
You know, he doesn't mince words, does he?
He does not. But then he does something really intriguing. He calls for a harpist. What is that all about?
It's the only time in the Bible we see a prophet potentially trying to enter a trance state.
Really?
Which some other ancient prophets did, and while Dr. Oswalt doesn't want to read too much into it,
right.
It does raise some interesting questions about the different ways prophets connected with the divine. You have to wonder, was this a common practice or something unique to Elisha?
It definitely adds another layer to the whole concept of prophecy. So harp music playing Elisha delivers Yahweh's message.
Right.
And it's a doozy. Not only is there going to be water in the desert, but victory over Moab is promised as well.
Yes.
But then things take a bit of a turn.
Yes. Elisha goes on to prophesy, or perhaps observe, that the Israelites will destroy Moabite cities, cut down trees, stop up springs, and ruin fields.
Oh, wow.
It's a stark reminder that victory in war often comes at a terrible price.
It's pretty intense.
Yeah.
So is this a divine command to wreak havoc, or is Elisha simply seeing a vision of what's to come?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Dr. Oswalt suggests that Elisha isn't necessarily relaying an order from God, but rather he is foreseeing the brutal realities of war. Hmm. He is essentially saying, this victory is coming, but here is the devastating cost.
It really makes you think about the complex interplay between human choices and divine providence. Just because something happens doesn't necessarily mean it's God's will, right?
Right. And that is a crucial insight for us today as well.
Right.
You know, we often assume that an open door is a sign from God. Hmm. But perhaps we should be more careful to consider whether our actions align with his will.
So the Moabites, they see this valley filled with water, and it's red, which makes them think that the allied armies have turned on each other.
Yeah.
So they rush in expecting an easy victory. And, well, things don't go quite as planned, do they?
Not at all. The Israelites are ready for them and completely rout the Moabite army. But the king of Moab, in a desperate attempt to turn the tide, makes a horrific decision.
Yeah.
He sacrifices his own son on the city walls. It is a truly disturbing act, and the text itself is pretty ambiguous about what happens next. It just says, the fury against Israel was great. They withdrew and returned to their own land. What does that even mean?
Right.
That's where interpretation gets really tricky. Who is furious? And why did the Israelites retreat?
Right.
Dr. Oswald presents several possibilities. Maybe the Israelites were horrified by the sacrifice and lost their stomach for the fight. Or perhaps it was Yahweh expressing his anger at the whole situation.
Hmm.
It could even be that the Moabites, driven to a frenzy by their king's act, became even fiercer, forcing the Israelites to back down.
So many layers to unpack. And we have not even touched on the other miracles Elisha performs. But before we move on to those, what stood out to you from this part of the story?
What struck me most was the contrast between Jehoram and Jehoshaphat's responses to the crisis.
Mm.
It is a powerful reminder that our worldview, our understanding of God, shapes how we face challenges.
Absolutely. Their reactions to the same situation reveal so much about the state of their hearts. You know, Jehoram, with his double-mindedness, sees this lack of water as a sign that God is against him, while Jehoshaphat, with his firm faith, turns to God for guidance. It's a powerful lesson for us even today as we face our own trials and tribulations.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating how, even with this resounding victory, the narrative does not shy away from those harsh realities of war. You know, the human horror, the moral ambiguities. It really makes you think.
It certainly does. This isn't a simple tale of good versus evil. And this complexity carries over as we move into 2 Kings chapter 4, where the focus shifts to Elisha and a series of miracles that he performs. But even these seemingly straightforward acts of divine power have layers of meaning, as Dr. Oswald points out, that invite us to dig a little deeper.
Okay, so let's dive into these miracles. What's the first one on the list? The story of a widow and her oil. This woman comes to Elisha in desperate straits. Her husband, who was a prophet, has passed away, leaving her burdened with debt. To make matters worse, creditors are threatening to take her two sons as slaves to cover what's owed.
It's heartbreaking to imagine her desperation. So what does Elisha do to help?
He starts by asking her a simple question. What do you have in your house? And she replies, nothing except a small jar of oil.
It's almost like those all I have is this moments that precede like amazing acts of faith. So what happens next?
Elisha instructs her to gather as many empty jars as she can from her neighbors.
Okay.
Then he tells her to go inside and pour the oil from her small jar into all the empty ones. And what follows is nothing short of astonishing.
The oil multiplies, doesn't it? Filling all the jars.
You got it. The oil keeps flowing till every single jar is full. The widow then sells the oil, settles her debts, and secures a future for herself and her sons.
On the surface, it's a beautiful story about God's provision in times of need.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Oswald suggests there is something more profound at play here.
I agree. He emphasizes that this miracle occurs within the context of Elisha's prophetic ministry. This woman is the widow of a prophet. someone who dedicated his life to serving Yahweh in a way, this miracle is a divine affirmation of that service.
Yeah.
It's as if God is saying, I see you, I honor your husband's faithfulness, and I will not abandon you.
That adds such depth to the story. It's not just about getting out of debt. It's about God's faithfulness to those who serve him, extending even beyond their earthly lives.
Exactly. This act of provision is a testament to God's covenant loyalty. It's an enduring promise that resonates with anyone who seeks to follow his path.
What's the next miracle that we encounter in Elisha's journey?
We meet a Shunammite woman who shows extraordinary hospitality to Elisha. She even builds a room on her roof so he has a comfortable place to stay whenever he passes through town.
It makes you wonder if she knew he was a prophet or if she just had a generous heart. Either way, it sounds like Elisha was fortunate to have her support.
Indeed, Elisha, touched by her kindness, desires to bless her. He asks what he can do for her, and she humbly replies, I have everything I need. But Gehazi, Elisha's servant, notices a deep sadness in her. She is barren, and her husband is quite old.
That must have been a painful reality for her, especially in a culture that placed so much value on having children.
It's certainly a sensitive topic, but Elisha, moved by her situation, prophesies that she will have a son within a year.
Wow.
And just as he foretold, she does conceive and gives birth to a son.
It seems every generation has its own stories of these miraculous births. So what happens to this child?
Sadly, a few years later, the boy suddenly falls ill and dies.
It's so difficult to reconcile such joy with such sudden tragedy. How does the Shunammite woman react to this devastating loss?
She doesn't succumb to despair. Instead, she shows remarkable strength and determination. She immediately sets out to find Elisha, unwavering in her belief that he can help.
She's a woman of action, driven by her faith. What does Elisha do when he hears of her plight?
He initially sends Gehazi ahead with his staff, hoping that would be enough to revive the child. However, it doesn't work. Elisha then goes to the house himself, enters the room where the boy lies lifeless, and stretches himself out upon him, praying fervently to God.
It's such a powerful image.
Mm-hmm.
So intimate and full of emotion. He's literally putting himself in the place of this boy, pleading for his life. What happens next?
The scene is charged with anticipation. And finally, the miracle unfolds. The boy sneezes 7 times and opens his eyes. He is alive.
It's a moment of profound relief, not just for the Shunammite woman, but for anyone who has ever faced the loss of a child or someone they love so dearly.
Absolutely. But Dr. Oswald emphasizes that this story isn't nearly about a miraculous healing. It's a testament to the power of persistent faith and the unwavering love of a mother.
Mm-hmm.
It speaks to the lengths we'll go to for those we cherish and the importance of clinging to hope, even when circumstances seem dire.
It's a story that reminds us that sometimes we need to fight for what we believe in, even when everything seems lost. It's about holding on to that tiny spark of faith, trusting that God can work miracles even in the darkest of times. So what other insights do we gain from Elisha's ministry in this chapter?
Well, Dr. Oswald highlights another miracle, which he refers to as a teaching miracle.
Okay.
It's the story of a group of prophets building a new living space. One of them unknowingly uses a poisonous gourd to make stew.
Oh, that's terrifying. Imagine accidentally poisoning an entire group of prophets. What happens when they realize their mistake?
They immediately recognize something is wrong with the stew and cry out to Elisha for help.
Okay.
He responds with an act that seems almost too simple. He throws some flour into the pot, and miraculously, the stew is rendered safe to eat.
It's almost anticlimactic, yet incredibly profound at the same time. Why does Dr. Oswald call this a teaching miracle?
He believes this act, though seemingly insignificant, conveys a powerful message about God's ability to transform even the most toxic situations. It illustrates that God can take something intended to harm us and turn it into something good. It's a reminder that even in moments where we feel poisoned by circumstances or choices, there's always potential for redemption and healing.
It's a message that resonates with anyone who's ever faced a situation that feels hopeless or beyond repair.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds us that God can work in unexpected ways to bring about restoration and wholeness.
Precisely. And all these stories taken together showcase the multifaceted nature of Elisha's ministry. He's not just a miracle worker. He's a teacher, a counselor, and a powerful intercessor.
Right.
He walks alongside people in their pain, points them towards God's power, and ultimately helps them find hope and healing.
It makes you realize that sometimes the greatest miracles aren't the ones that defy the laws of nature, but the ones that transform our hearts and minds, opening us to that boundless love and grace of God. Where does this deep dive into Elisha's ministry take us next? It's incredible how these stories, though rooted in this distant past, still speak to our human experience. You know, we all face challenges, we yearn for hope, and we need these reminders that we are not alone in our struggles. And what's striking about Elisha's ministry is that it seems to touch on these universal themes time and time again.
I couldn't agree more. And there's this final thought from Dr. Oswald that I found particularly resonant. He talks about how God often chooses seemingly ordinary means to achieve extraordinary results. It's not always about parting seas or raining fire from heaven.
Right.
Sometimes it's about a jar of oil, a handful of flour, or the unwavering faith of a heartbroken mother.
It's like that saying, God doesn't always call the qualified, but he qualifies the called. You know, we don't have to be superheroes or biblical giants to be instruments of God's work. He can use anyone who is willing to answer his call, no matter how small or insignificant they might feel. And that is incredibly encouraging, isn't it?
It is. It's a message of hope and empowerment. It tells us that God can work through our unique gifts, our passions, and even our weaknesses to impact the world around us.
It's a beautiful reminder that every act of kindness, every word of encouragement, every prayer whispered from the heart can be a vessel for God's grace and power.
Beautifully put, and I think that's a perfect point to reflect on as we wrap up our deep dive into Elisha's journey as we navigate our daily lives. It's crucial to remember that God is at work in both the ordinary and the extraordinary. He invites each of us to be part of his story, regardless of where we are or what we're facing.
This has been an incredible exploration of Elisha's ministry. Thank you, expert speaker, for guiding us through these fascinating stories and illuminating their deeper meaning. And to you, dear listener, we leave you with this final question. What seemingly ordinary opportunities exist in your life right now that God might be using to accomplish something extraordinary? Take a moment to reflect, to pray, and to be open to the ways God might be calling you to participate in his work in the world.
Until next time, may you be blessed with the wisdom to discern God's presence in your life and the courage to answer his call.